Hello and welcome to the menu on Monocle 24. I am Marcus Hippi. In the next 30 minutes, Fernando Trocca on his cooking philosophy that has made him one of the most respected and successful chefs in Latin America.
I think now I try to be more simple and less complicated. And I think less are more.
Then we will hear about a uniquely Mexican success story.
As Mexico recovered from the Great Depression, the humble business went on to change the fate of a region which had survived on agriculture and cattle.
All that plus the week's top headlines and Adidas soundtrack recommendation ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. Argentinian top chef Fernando Trocca is one of the biggest names in Latin America's culinary scene. He opened his restaurant Sucre in Buenos Aires in 2001, and ever since the place has been a regular fixture in ranking lists of the best restaurants in the world. Last year he brought the concept to the UK and opened his restaurant in a building that was once home to the London College of Music. We talked about the launch, Fernando's cooking philosophy and the evolution of Argentinian cooking when he joined me at Midori House Studio One. First, he explained how his career with food began.
That was long time ago. I need to divide the question in two parts. The first one will be when I was a kid, and I used to spend a lot of time with my grandmother, and she was an immigrant from Italy, and she used to have a pension, like a house that she was renting rooms in San Telmo. San Telmo is the old part of Buenos Aires. So my mother passed away when I was a kid. So I spent a lot of time with her. And she was an amazing, not a professional chef, but she was an amazing cooking. So I spent a lot of time with her in the kitchen. And she was teaching me how to cook because I love food.
What kind of things did you learn then?
Oh, she was doing a lot of things, not only Italian food, but every Sunday she was making pasta by hand, but she was doing, I don't know, milanesas that are very typical in Argentina, risottos, pastas, everything. So that's probably the beginning. And then when I was 19 or 20 years old, I was a little lost in my life, like normal. I was trying to see what will be my career. And then eventually decide to be a chef. But in that time was completely difficult because it wasn't any cooking school. No one wants to be a chef. And this is probably 33 years ago. I mean, now it's very popular. It's cooking school everywhere in Buenos Aires, TV shows. But in that time was very difficult. So I went to the south in Patagonia because in that time it was the only cooking school, but I couldn't go in because the school in that time didn't have any student or professors. So I decided to go back to Buenos Aires and I started to work in a kitchen. I mean, I didn't know anything about kitchen. Just I was cooking at my home for my father, my brother, my sister, my friends. So that was the beginning. I was working in a kitchen, doing cleaning, doing starters, some desserts.
And if we fast forward a few years after that, one milestone in your career was in 2001 when you launched your restaurant Sucre in Buenos Aires, and where the timing wasn't exactly optimal for that, was it?
Yeah, exactly. In 1997, I decided to move to New York because New York in that time was a city that it was very exciting for me. So I was traveling to New York just to be inspired by the city. And 1997, I decided to leave everything and move there without speak any English, no visa, nothing. I moved there and it was an amazing decision. I was cooking. I was a chef from a very successful restaurant in that time in New York. And that happened in 1997. And in middle of 2000, I decided to go back to Argentina because we had the plans to open Sucre in Buenos Aires. So I didn't have the money to put in Sucre, but I moved to Buenos Aires. So two of my partners, they owed me the money. And finally, we opened Sucre. And it was like 2 months later was probably one of the biggest crises in Argentina. It was a huge devaluation. So the dollars went from 1 to 3. It was unbelievable. But to be honest, Sucre was like a bubble because it was amazing, amazing. We did an amazing business in the restaurant.
What do you think you got right in 2001 then? Why was Sucre such a success from the very beginning? Was it something you learned in New York that you brought with you?
I think it was three things. I always say that one was the open kitchen that in that time in Buenos Aires was completely unusual. The other thing that the place, we built the restaurant from nothing. So it's an amazing building with high, high ceilings. So we have a big open kitchen at the back. We have a beautiful wood grill and a wood rotisserie. Also, we have an amazing bar, huge bar, and a big wine cellar in the middle of the restaurant. That three things was very important in that moment in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. The wine, the bar, and an open kitchen. That was very unusual.
So you opened your restaurant Sucre in Buenos Aires in 2001, and you were faced with a huge financial crisis in the country very soon after that. And a very interesting timing for you to launch your second outpost of Sucre in London last year, when the pandemic was nowhere nearly over.
Yes, that happened because I was working here in London in 2008. I started to be a consulting chef from a big company, Gaucho. And the person that used to own that company, he bought Sucre. So we became partners in Sucre, Argentina. And he said to me, that was probably 3-4 years ago, we will open Sucre in London. And I say, okay, it will be amazing, but... And I didn't realize. And finally, we opened Sucre in London and we opened Sucre in Dubai. I mean, for me, it's probably the bigger challenge in my life, in my career, to open a restaurant in London. Because I think that London, Paris and New York, for me, are the three best city to eat. But London, it is, I mean, still a big challenge. So we opened Sucre last July. And I'm very happy. We're doing very well. I was putting all together, trying to bring some of the inspiration of Sucre Buenos Aires to London. So we have the open kitchen. We have a nice and beautiful open fire, wood oven. I'm very happy.
I think it's interesting that you say that it was such a challenge to open a restaurant in London. I'm wondering if you compare, for example, Sucre Buenos Aires and Sucre London, how different are they? Did you have to adjust the restaurant concept to the local culture here in London?
In terms of the core, it's very different. And building, it's completely different. The building in Buenos Aires, it was built by us from scratch. And here it's a beautiful old building. That was one of the first music school. So the place is very different. The atmosphere also is very different. But probably the inspiration about the food, it's very similar. And ingredients also are very different. Ingredients here are unbelievable. We were trying to use Argentinian beef, but I decided to go for English beef because we were trying... Many different type of beef and meat. And finally, we decide to go for a small farm called Paddock Farm that they have an unbelievable meat.
Local meat. How far away from London is that place?
I think it's very... I didn't see the space yet, but I think it's very close. It's like an hour from here.
Very local meat. I'm wondering if you look at the menus in Sucre Buenos Aires and Sucre London, for example, do they share many dishes or are they very different? They are very different.
No, they're very different. To be honest, on the Sucre menu in Buenos Aires, I don't work a lot in Sucre Buenos Aires since the last probably 5 or 6 years. So the menu now is in charge of the head chef of Sucre Buenos Aires. And can have some similarities, but no, they're not. Probably one of the dishes are the same. That it's a dish that I was doing since my grandmother teach me. It was a risotto, ossobuco risotto.
Amazing, amazing. I wonder, what are your highlights or favorites from the menu you have here in London?
The prime rib from Paddock Farm. It's for sure one of them. Dulce de leche molten cake. it's other. And then black rice, it's another one. And I did a new one just now, put it on the menu 3 days ago, that it's a whole sole fish on the grill and comes with mussels, mushrooms, chili, garlic, and olive oil.
Amazing. I'm wondering, how are these recipes born, or where do you get your inspiration? You've mentioned your travels a few times in this interview already. I'm wondering, how important are your travels, for example, to find that inspiration and ideas, and where else do they come from? Do you read many cookbooks, for example? Are you following what other chefs do?
Definitely, yes. I have inspiration for many, many different things. Definitely books. I bought books all the time. Traveling probably is the most. I love to travel, and I always go to cities and see new restaurants, new places. I have a list of all the places that I go that I share with my friends, and magazines, markets, products. Inspiration comes from many different things.
Any recent favorite things, favorite cookbooks, or favorite destinations to travel?
Favorite destination, probably Copenhagen. I love Denmark, and I really like Copenhagen. I try to go once a year because it's a lot of new chef, new restaurants, new ideas. And I think for me, the food in Copenhagen are very different to the way that I used to cook or see the kitchen on the food. And books, many books. Probably the classic one is the Silver Spoon, that it's like a Bible.
I'm wondering, your career has lasted for some years now. I'm wondering, how has your cooking style evolved during that time? If you think how you prepared your food when you were 25 compared to what you're doing nowadays.
Very different. Sometimes when I discover old menus from 20 years ago, I discovered that definitely my style changed a lot.
How does it feel like, by the way, reading those old menus and seeing what you've been doing?
Sometimes I'm laughing because I say, how I can do this dish? I realized that was in a different moment of Argentina. It was a completely different moment for me as well as a chef. And I think now I try to be more simple and less complicated. And I think less are more.
It's probably also more difficult.
Yes, probably it's more difficult. Yes. But I really enjoy it. And I think that now probably I'm much more focused on the product, on the final dish.
Are there some ingredients you've only started using recently? If you look at those old menus, are there some ingredients that are missing there that you're using nowadays?
A lot of organic ingredients and natural ingredients that probably in Argentina 20 years ago, it was a very little option. So I think that people now much more care about what they eat. I think it's a challenge for us, for chefs and for restaurants, but I think it's a very nice and interesting challenge.
Do you follow food trends carefully, and do you try to react to food trends? I'm wondering, what is your relationship with veganism, for example?
I mean, I obviously respect vegans and vegetarian. Probably here, because in Argentina, we don't have a lot of vegans. We have, obviously, but here we always need to think on vegan dishes on the menu. And I like, because also it's a challenge for me, because vegetarian is much more easy. But vegan, you always put an ingredient and say, no, this ingredient cannot be on the vegan.
I was also asking this question because I find it fascinating, because people may know that Argentinian food is quite meaty. You've actually said yourself once that one of the most essential ingredients in Argentinian cuisine is meat.
Yes.
Is that still so?
Yes, definitely, yes. Argentinians, we eat meat probably 4 times a week. I'm trying to not eat a lot of meat now. But yes, because the meat, it's used to be amazing, not anymore. Now, if you want to have amazing beef in Argentina, it's much more difficult than before, because unfortunately, it's a lot of feedlot now going around in Argentina, but people still eating a lot of meat, yes. And also because it's not expensive.
Just finally, Fernando, before I let you go, I should ask one question. I know that many of our listeners are working in the industry, and many of them are maybe taking their first steps in the industry. How do you become a successful chef like you?
I always say that my experience for me is the best because I never went to the school. But many, many years later, I was teaching in a cooking school. Not anymore, but I was doing that for like 3 years. And I think that people that wants to be a chef, I mean, they can go to, it's a lot of very good cooking school around the world. But I think that the first step, it's always go into the kitchen in a restaurant, do a stage and see if they like. And then they can decide if they want to learn from the kitchen, from inside the kitchen, or they can go to a school and then start in a restaurant.
What kind of a boss are you, by the way, in the kitchen, when you are in the kitchen?
I'm a very good one. I never scream. I mean, I think that for me, the team are everything in a restaurant. If we don't have a nice and good team, we don't have a restaurant. And I like to have a great relation with the chefs. I want to be fun in the kitchen because work in the kitchen is not an easy thing and is very stress. So I think that if on top of that I put much more stress, it will be much more difficult and the result wouldn't be good. I'm a very calm person in general, so I try to bring that into the kitchen.
Fernando Trocca there. You are with the menu on Monocle 24. Let's next continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Paige Reynolds.
Thanks, Marcus. A Russian fast food chain built to replace McDonald's has revealed a new logo, which bears a close resemblance to the famous Golden Arches. Uncle Vanya's gold and red branding features the Russian letter V, which looks like an English letter B. Last week, a Russian politician said the country should start its own version of McDonald's after the fast food giant announced it would exit the country following the invasion of Ukraine. Restaurants and cafes in the US city of Portland can continue using public parking and city streets as outdoor dining areas after the local council extended a pandemic scheme. Permits for hospitality venues, other businesses and community gatherings will now be valid through to the end of August, when they will be able to apply for a permanent permit. Luxury brand Gucci is set to open a new Osteria di Massimo Bottura restaurant in Seoul, the Italian brand's fourth. The renowned fine dining experience began in Florence in 2018 and has since been awarded a Michelin star. The new outpost menu will feature reinterpretations of Korean classics. And Shanghai-based chef Paul Paré is set to open a new restaurant in Paris. Originally from France, Paré's La Brasserie du Mont will be located in the Hôtel du Crayon in the 8th arrondissement. He has three restaurants in Shanghai, Mr. and Mrs. Bund, Pollux, and three Michelin-starred Ultraviolet. Those are the week's headlines. Now back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Paige. You are with the menu. Anyone who visits Mexico can't fail to discover an ice cream parlor with pink and white walls, offering frozen delicacies in flavors you've never even heard of. La Michoacana is a uniquely Mexican success story. It might even be as well known as McDonald's in the United States, but one key difference is that it's not just a single company, brand, or even a franchise. Monocle's Ana Gonzalez went on a quest to find out how it went from a family-run business to becoming a national icon, and she sent us this report.
With high temperatures and humidity, it always feels like a good time to get a cold treat in Mexico City's trendy Roma Sur neighborhood. At the famous Mercado Medellin, locals and foreigners buy colorful fruits and vegetables, drink coffee, and enjoy a spicy lunch listening to rancheras and jarocho. Next to the entrance, you'll find not just one, but two ice cream parlors, or paleterias, sitting opposite each other on the same street. They both have the same name, La Michoacana, but the logo, the prices, and some of the products on offer are slightly different. It's an extreme example of a wider trend that can be seen all over Mexico, as culinary journalist Pedro Reyes explains.
Todas son La Michoacana.
It almost never tastes the same. Some of the drinks have more sugar than others. Some have colorants, others are natural. At one shop, they might have a list with 80 flavors, and the next one has 20 more. There were people who copied the logo, and instead of having the image of an island with an ice cream, they used an ice lolly. Mexicans are always going to find a way to do these kinds of tricks, but the case of La Michoacana went really far.
Pedro told me there was a massive paleteria boom in Mexico City during the 1960s. The original owners came from a town called Tocumbo in Michoacán State. About three decades earlier, a pioneer named Rafael Malfavón had started selling homemade fruit ice lollies that he carried around on his donkey. As Mexico recovered from the Great Depression, the humble business went on to change the fate of a region which had survived on agriculture and cattle, as well as creating countless jobs across the country.
La paleta de agua cuesta 25.
In the balmy coastal town of La Paz, I dropped in to a Michoacana to ask about their most popular products.
Las de fruta llevan pura fruta, como la piña, parte de las piñas.
Christopher López is chopping a pineapple, carefully measuring water and sugar to make a frozen lolly mix with juicy chunks of fruit.
Completamente llena de pura fruta y no quede ningún espacio de agua. Cada quien la hace a su gusto. Un litro y medio de limón.
I make the lemon one to my taste, adding a liter and a half of lemon, 3 spoons of sugar, and around 18 to 20 liters of water. It depends on how much you want to make. I also add a liter of cream so it keeps the right texture. It never tastes the same. Every shop has its own recipe. If I add a liter and a half of lemon, the other shop might use one or two.
As a child, Christopher picked up local recipes by helping family members at a Michoacana in his home state of Guanajuato. His brother also learned the trade and works at another parlor close by, but for different owners. Everything goes by word of mouth, and Christopher feels fortunate to have skills that keep him off the streets.
I think around 50% of the population of the villages in my home area work for La Michoacana. It's a big source of employment. Just here in La Paz, there might be about 25 shops. It's impossible to know how many exist in the whole country.
It's a successful business model that has been replicated across the Republic. People say the first proper paleteria was set up in the early 40s at a site where Tocumbo's National Archive now lies. Its master artisans were the Alcázar Pulido brothers, who later started loaning money to families who created the spin-off Michoacanas. As those loans were paid back, the stores kept multiplying, along with different strategies for success, as Michoacana expert Martín González explains.
The owners know very well which fruit they should use, what's cheaper, seasonal, and what people like. They want to sell this idea of freshness, so they use local products and they find thousands of ways to make their businesses profitable. It's not a business where a small group of people get tremendously wealthy, but many people benefit. It's not a pyramid system.
González literally wrote the book on La Michoacana. He told me how ambitious ice cream makers expanded to Panama and the United States, unwittingly committing serial copyright fraud. One group poached a Disney logo in the 1960s, but they got away with it, because taking legal action against such a small business wouldn't have paid off. It's something a legit company would never have dreamed of doing, and perfectly conveys the unintended creative genius of La Michoacana. The result is an unprecedented level of brand consolidation and visibility, achieved with a marketing budget of precisely zero. For journalist Pedro Reyes, it's a heartwarming story, which puts a smile on his face.
Tocumbo fuera contrario a muchos pueblos de Michoacán donde hay mucha pobreza.
What happened in Tocumbo is incredible and very different to most towns in the state of Michoacán, where there's a lot of poverty. They even have a massive ice lolly monument to welcome visitors, the kind of thing one only sees in Mexico. It must be really beautiful to know that your village became prosperous thanks to someone who made paletas.
Prosperado a partir de alguien que se dedicó a vender paletas.
Kiwi, coco, grosella, maracuyá, tamarindo, guanábana, sandía.
The name La Michoacana conjures up nostalgic memories for Mexicans from all walks of life. Everyone has their favorite flavor, whether it's simple lime, horchata, Jamaica flowers, or spicy chamoy sauce mixed with mango. In the United States, migrants miss it so much that paleterias have popped up from Colorado to California. And who knows, maybe one day an enterprising ice cream lover could even try and bring this unique Mexican creation across the Atlantic.
Tenemos de crema, vainilla, arroz con leche, chocolate, chicle, nuez.
For Monocle in Mexico, I'm Ana González.
Galleta Oreo, ciruela pasa, queso Philadelphia con frutas, Nutella, fresa con crema y fresa de leche. Y lo que son los esquimales, paleta de vainilla cubierta con chocolate, coco y nuez.
That story was produced by Frederick Berners. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at 13:00 if you're listening in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, do check out our Menu spin-off show Food Neighborhoods for great recipes. This show was edited and mixed by David Stevens, and I am Markus Hippi. Once again, we finish this program with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. From France, here is Alexia Gredy with Vertigo. Thanks for listening.